Hello, hello, everyone. Welcome back. This is episode 16 of the Government Coins podcast. And today I'm super excited. We have a very unique company that's coming to speak to us today. And it's also in the realm of startups and how to create solutions to work for government agencies and the communities that we represent, y'all. Okay. So we're definitely going to get into this. Zach, would you mind introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about who you are?
Sure. Shakia, thanks for having me. So my name is Zach Burke. I'm the founder and managing partner at Exigy. My background, should I give you a little bit about my background and then tell you a bit about Exigy?
Yeah.
So my background is in both software engineering, design, as well as nonprofit and social justice work. And so for many years, I kind of did one of those over here and one of those over here. When I was younger, I started businesses. I did a lot with technology and startups. And then in another hand, I was helping to co-found and start nonprofits, scale those. And around when I was in my early 20s, just as I finished university, I was launching a wireless internet service provider, a technology startup. And I was also deep into having helped to grow a nonprofit at the college I went to. And so I ended up both getting an AmeriCorps Vista grant to grow that nonprofit and scale it across the Northeast, as well as at the same time, raise funding and scale a technology startup. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing those two things at once, and they both kind of came to a natural conclusion. My AmeriCorps Vista fellowship ended, and the business came to a natural conclusion. And I moved back out to California, and I decided I wanted to take both of those things that I was holding in separate hands and stop holding them separately and put them all together. And I wanted to take the things I was good at, design and technology, and apply it to the problems and organizations I really cared about: nonprofits, governments focused on social services, progressive political organizations. And so that became Exigy. I really started just kind of freelancing, doing software engineering for small nonprofits, progressive political organizations, and got busy and hired some folks to help. And so when we then learned about the B Corp movement about a few years in, that became a natural fit. So we became a certified B Corp. We've been a B Corp for, gosh, it's probably about 12 or 13 years now. And so Exigy today, we are a digital studio. We use design and technology to improve lives. So the team is folks like me, software engineers, but also designers and product managers, the kinds of folks who you would find at a Facebook or a Google or a Twitter, but they come and they work at Exigy because they want to use their skills mm-hmm. to create progressive social change at scale to help people and improve lives.
Nice. Now you mentioned something in that, and I kind of wanted you to hit on it a little bit. You talked about the B Corp, and what is a B Corp? Would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. So B Corps have been around since probably about like 2009, I want to say, and we became a B Corp in 2010. B Corps are essentially business being used as a force for good. B Corps are certified businesses, kind of like you would get certified as an organic business or a fair trade business. We go through a rigorous third-party assessment that's run by a nonprofit called B-Lab. B-Lab runs this pretty intense review process with every organization that wants to become a B Corp. And every couple of years we go through that, we get a score. And if you get a high enough score, then you can become a certified B Corp. If you don't get a high enough score, that's okay. You've got a roadmap. They've given you a list of things that you need to improve on as a business so that you can become a certified B Corp, which is really powerful. Because when they hand that back to a really large business, then that business sees, oh, wow, here's these things I need to do to make sure that I'm impacting all stakeholders. Not just my shareholders, like most businesses take account for, but the communities we work with, our partners, the environment. B Corps take into account all stakeholders, and the B Lab impact assessment is like a roadmap for organizations to become better, better community members, better businesses. In addition to being a B Corp, we're also a benefit corp, which is a different thing. That's a legal structure. And that's a legal structure that protects a business that allows them to actually take other stakeholders into account. You may not know this, but most businesses can't take anyone but shareholders into account. If a business makes a decision that's good for the environment, but bad for shareholders, shareholders can sue them. Right. Wow. And so like, even if a business wants to be good, it can't. So you need these legal structures like benefit corps that allow businesses to take the environment and all stakeholders into account. And so we're both a certified B Corp as well as a registered benefit corp in the state of California. In some states, those are called public benefit corps. Same idea. It's just different in different states.
Nice. That's very nice. And to hear about that, because, you know, especially right now, we talk a lot about capital and profits and everything. We never get to the point of how are we really doing this to serve the community, as I from marketing campaigns and things like that, right? Nice marketing campaigns.
More than just CSR, I think, is a concise way of describing B Corp.
Definitely more than CSR. I like that. And I wanted to talk a little bit more. So how would you say Exegy has changed from when you started and working with, you know, clients that you had before, like Move On, to where you are now? Like, what is the essence of Exegy, and that what has remained the same and allowed you to work within these spaces continuously?
Yeah. Thanks for that. Great question. I think some of the things that have remained the same are our values and the sort of why we're doing it, right? To use what we're good at to make the world better. And, you know, I think that's, in some ways, that's like a very selfish endeavor because it's really satisfying to feel like you're using your skills for good. And so selfishly, that has remained, that has been like true to why we got started and has remained true to the business today. But what has changed is kind of how we do that, how we use what we're good at, which I'll kind of describe as digital. How do we use digital to make the world better? You know, when we started, it was just me. I was a software engineer. And so I thought, how can I write code that makes the world better? And I think we quickly learned that just writing code is not enough, right? Engineers writing it on their white horses generally just screw things up and make things worse because they really don't, we don't understand problems. We understand problems the way engineers understand problems. Like, we break things apart and put them back together. And it's like, we think in spreadsheets, you know, and like algorithms. And problems and people, problems, especially problems that involve people, which are all the most like meaty and important problems in the world, don't break down like spreadsheets and algorithms, because people are, turns out, like a lot more complex than like spreadsheets and algorithms, right? Don't tell the AI I said that. So we grew, as we learned that, we realized we had to grow our skill set. And so what that meant was bringing on more folks in just engineering, bringing on designers and product managers. And when we first brought on design, we were like, oh yeah, design, those are like the people that make like the pictures pretty. Right? Yeah. But what design really means is it means, I think when we use it, we mean a really broad spectrum of skills, under all of which are undergirded by being in the community and trying to understand people's problems and have help people to articulate solutions themselves that we then can show back to them and say, is this what you meant? Get their feedback and then say, is this what you meant? Be like, great, then this is what we should build, right? Mm-hmm. And so building that design research skill set, having a team of researchers and product managers who can do that, who can be in the community so that what we're doing is building things with the community rather than for the community, which I think is what we were doing originally. We were just like engineers. Has meant that now we're building things that people really need and that actually solve problems rather than building the things that we thought were right, that when we launched them, it turned out like, you know, we had this like field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. And like, it's not, you know.
Wow. I feel that's like an epiphany. I did the same exact thing. Build a solution and they will come. Then you go and then they want something completely different. So I love the fact that, you know, you you incorporate that design and community aspect into the developing of the solutions. So can we talk a little bit about some of the projects that you've worked on? I know that's, you know, just some examples to let people know.
Well, I think one of the projects we're most known for is our work in affordable housing. We've been working in affordable housing for probably 6 or 7 years now. We have a product we've built that started, it's called Bloom Housing. And what it is it's a web portal for folks to find and apply to government subsidized affordable housing opportunities. And it's for local jurisdictions, cities, counties, states. We started it with the city and county of San Francisco. Came out with a RFP that said, hey, we want to build a one-stop shop for affordable housing. And the RFP was like really great because it was not this 200-page list of requirements. It was just, hey, we just want to like go into the community and figure out what they want. Like, would you like to do that with us? And we were like, boom, that's what we want to do. So we raised our hand, we responded, we won. And when we got in there, we said, hey guys, like, what do you think about making it open source too? And they thought that sounded all right. So we got them to agree to that. And so what that meant was that after we launched something really quick, something small, we do this MVP, minimal viable products. We built something really small, really fast, and we kept building on top of it, more stuff. And after a couple of years of doing that, adding features, making it better for users, better for government, better for nonprofits who are using it, we could start going to neighboring jurisdictions. So we started with City and County of San Francisco. We went over to Alameda County, which is Berkeley and Oakland are, went down to the city of San Jose, largest city in the Bay Area, and went down to San Mateo County, just to the south, and started showing them this and said, hey, City and County of San Francisco did this. It's open source. Would you want to do this too? And everyone was like, totally. We've wanted this kind of thing forever. Like, how do we do it? And then we had to figure out like the answer to that, how do we do it? Which was like, we had to learn a ton about government procurement. And so then we ended up essentially building a product around that. And so now we have this line of work where we're implementing this open source product, Bloom Housing, for jurisdictions around the country. We've now launched all around the Bay Area. We've launched in the city of Detroit, and we're working with some other jurisdictions now as well, but those are where we've launched so far. That's probably the work we're known for best, but we also do work in all kinds of social services and benefits. We do work with cities on websites, on mobile apps. We help folks to find services, apply to services. We help folks, we really just help government think about how to use digital, often to take a service that they've been delivering for 50 years and think about how to deliver it more efficiently in a modern age that's better for end users, better for government, better for everyone. And we do that not just with governments, but we do it with nonprofits. We do it with really all kinds of organizations that are trying to deliver services.
Yes, I like that. And I was definitely going to ask you, I got two questions based off of the answer. So the first one is, I love how you mentioned you created the product and then you basically shopped it around to different agencies. That was awesome. Would you mind telling us a little bit about like that government approach to different projects specifically, and like how you go and shop these opportunities around, I guess?
Yeah, I think in some ways it was the dumbest idea ever because like if we were a startup and we had this piece of software and we wanted like to get our first customers, which is essentially in retrospect what we were doing. If you went to a funder like a VC and you said, okay, I'm going to go after customers who take 3 years to buy.
That one.
They would be like, maybe you should try and find another customer because that sounds like a really crappy customer. So, I mean, it literally took the minimum of 3 years from when we started our first conversations to have our first customers for this product. And, you know, we're talking dozens of presentations and conversations and to get to the point where we could figure out what, how do we get other governments to use this thing? Mm-hmm. And we've gotten a little better at it. Like we've, you know, learned and gotten some tips and tricks, and I can talk a little bit about that, but it's still a challenge. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why government doesn't deliver great software often, and is because not a lot of companies want to deliver software for government, because government's not a great customer. It's not a great business model. So, you know, I think we've got a great thing going. Like we're super lucky. We were partly able to, you know, I said, if you went to a VC and you said, I want a customer in 3 years, they'd tell you to go take a hike. We're lucky in that we're a revenue driven small business. So we don't have pressure from outside investors to be like, whoa, go scale faster. You know, like we could just take our time to be like, we know this is something the world needs. We know this is like, it's going to take a while. Sure. But we're in it for the long haul. Yeah. We've been, you know, as a business, we've been revenue like profitable since day one for 15 years. So we just had the luxury of not having to, you know, be at 10x, 10x, 10x every
year. Every time.
Yeah. So that's been, that works for our business model. But I think it's more challenging for business models that require outside investment.
Absolutely. I think that's a good way of putting it for sure. Cause you definitely have to make that money back. They want it quickly. And then the other question, you said that the software was created as open source, and that is very, like, that's something that is, how did you get them to agree to that? And then also, would you mind explaining a little bit, but first explaining what open source is, and then on the back end, how'd you get them to agree to that?
Sure. So open source means that the code is available freely for anyone to look at, download, and reuse. Mm-hmm. And it's what the entire internet is built on, right? Like the internet is built on the back of huge open source projects. So, you know, you've heard of like Linux and the Apache web server and, you know, JavaScript, right? Like these are things you've heard of. And, you know, you may have different, the audience may have different like levels of understanding of what each of those things are. Each of those things is a giant piece of open source software that itself is a fundamental building block of the internet. And without it, nothing, none of the things that Google could not exist without all those open source, freely licensed pieces of software. So it's a critical concept, and it's in some ways it's like super counterintuitive, right? Because how do you like, it doesn't feel very capitalistic in our very capitalistic society to like do things and then be like, and it's free, you know? But there are business models that you can run around open source software, like, you know, famously Red Hat was one of the first pioneers in creating a monetization model around the Linux operating system. Or companies like Automattic, which runs WordPress, which is open source piece of software that's used by a huge number of organizations in the world. Similarly, Acquia is a company that runs Drupal. So there are a number of these organizations that run like really big open source projects that have both a revenue model and our open source. And it's our opinion as an organization that when government writes software, the default should be it's open source, because taxpayers are paying for it. And if taxpayers are paying for it, then taxpayers should be able to see it. And taxpayers should be able to reuse it if they want. And another government should be able to reuse it. And that part's really critical, because like so many times in which like governments are reinventing things, and like one's doing the same thing over here and over there, And they're each doing it kind of poorly too, because truthfully, doing software really well is really expensive, right? Mm-hmm. Like government tends to underestimate how much work it is to build great software, right? Governments used to putting their web development team in the IT department. And IT is used to buying laptops and buying like licenses to Microsoft Word. And like, okay, I pay $199 a year for my Microsoft Word license. Like, why should I pay a bunch of money for like, but if you think about a great software product, like think about Gmail, like, how many product managers, designers, and engineers do you think Google employs to make Gmail as good as it is and make it better every year? I'm telling you, it's not two, right? It's hundreds, if not like thousands. I have no idea, but like it's a lot of people on the Gmail team, right? And each of those people earns a salary and benefits. And so like, if you think about that as the cost of building a great piece of software, then you can imagine that it costs a lot of money to build and maintain great pieces of software. But what government does is they underinvest, they build something kind of like mediocre. And one of the reasons I think open source can be great for government is that it allows governments to pool funds, right? Because especially like state and local governments, like how do they build custom things? They can't afford to do a Gmail project, right? But so for example, our housing work, San Francisco funded it first, and then Alameda County funded it, and then City of San Jose is funding it, and then San Jose. And so like, and each one of them throwing money in makes it better for everybody else. And none of them could have done it on their own, right? But by all of them doing it together, we have a great piece of software. So I think open source is something that governments should do more of. They're often scared of it for probably just because it's hard to, you know, it just took me 10 minutes to explain it poorly, you know? And so like, so folks, you know, I think maybe it's just not an intuitive thing, and it's not how work has been done to date. And so it can be you got to pull in legal counsel and convince them that this is a good idea and that no one's going to get sued. And I don't want to be like, it's not right for everything, right? There's use cases where like, I don't think everything in our national defense system should be open source necessarily, instead of right now, which is like we default to closed, I think it'd be great if we could default to open and then make, you know, pick and choose the few things that need to be closed source.
Yeah. Or at least have some way that agencies across the board can utilize it, you know, if it's open source, even if you don't show it completely to the public, give bits and pieces of it, but make it to where agencies across the board. I think that's awesome. How you said one county paid for the initial setup, and it got better and better after that. Like there's so much value in that. There's so much value in not having to start from scratch. And I feel like that is a huge component. And I think another thing that agencies do as well is they're easily married to old-fashioned technology solutions. So I think that's one of the things too. So as opposed to transitioning from something that's not working, let's just add something on top of it. But I saw that face, Zach. I sensed a little bit of frustration in the air.
Layering things on top of other things is, I think, something that government does a lot of that can kind of just kick cans down the road and let the can get bigger and bigger. And I think that manifests in many ways, you know, through the software solutions like you're talking about, but also through all the processes that they put in place in order to like be able to work with government.
Mm-hmm. I think that's another conversation for another day, but the processes of working with them, especially from a startup perspective or just a design thinking aspect. You know, usually agencies are putting out RFPs with information as to we want exactly this. And that works for certain spaces, but as we have a conversation about technology and providing things that are community or front facing, that requires a lot more than this is exactly what I'm asking for, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, that process is great when you're buying screwdrivers and
of course,
but because you know I need exactly 100 of these, right? Mm-hmm. But when you don't, when you haven't yet engaged your community, and then, you know, you, that means that some procurement official is going to have to like write an RFP, and no one in the community has been consulted, and they're going to make it, and procurement's so painful for everyone, not just for folks on the vendor side, but for government itself. It takes so long that they're like, okay, we got to pack here because we don't want to have to do this again for a while, you know? Yeah. So we'll take 6 months or a year, we'll write this thing that gets bigger and bigger. And then we packed all our assumptions into it, right? Now it's all our assumptions in this box. We haven't tested any of our assumptions, but like, you know, it'll be all right. And then, 5 years later, we launch something that nobody asked for, right? Mm. We never tested our assumptions. And so many government projects kind of go that way, where we launch something that's not exactly what, or very much not what anybody wanted. And then we get to the solution that you described, which is like, okay, so what are we going to put on top of it to fix it? We just spent all this money on this thing. Okay, so like, what if we add Oracle? Okay, let's add Oracle.
You know, oh, Lord.
Well, no one, you know, Oracle, or like, you know, we'll bring in Accenture. They'll fix it, yeah. You know?
And
like
everything. You know, the gamut, all of the ones. So yes. So, okay. So I am really enjoying this conversation, especially around the technology aspect of it and understanding that design thinking aspect and then applying it to government. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about the nonprofit side. You mentioned that earlier, and basically bridging those two, between the nonprofit side and or the private side and the government side. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Oh, and then also if any of the projects seem to overlap.
I mean, that's exactly right, is that they all overlap, right? Because if we're working with government on delivering social services, mm-hmm. then in almost every case, there's some community organizations that they're working with to deliver those services, or there's some community organizations that have a much better understanding of the community, that have access to community members, mm-hmm. who really know what should be built, right, or what is really needed. And so in social services, all our government work is also nonprofit work.
Got it.
And
okay.
Vice versa, in nonprofit work, in many cases, the work is in some way being funded by government, or is rolling up. And if it's funded by government, it's rolling up to some objectives or outcomes that government is looking to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And so we've got stakeholders at some agency that are creating the reason for the work to exist and are stakeholders in the work. And so in both nonprofit and government work, all of it is complex because it's a multi-stakeholder environment, right? Like we're not, you know, in just to use housing as an example, if we just built a product that government wanted, then we'd be ignoring applicants. Mm-hmm. And if we only built a product that applicants wanted, we'd be ignoring nonprofit housing developers. And if we only built a product that nonprofit housing developers wanted, we'd be ignoring for-profit housing developers who in many jurisdictions are being required to build inclusionary housing that's mm-hmm. designated as permanently affordable. And if we only built things for them, then we'd be ignoring the housing advocates who are advocating for particular communities who don't typically have a seat at the table because they're marginalized. And so if we want to build something that works for everyone, then all of those stakeholders, advocates, nonprofit community organizations, nonprofit housing developers, for-profit developers, housing authorities, housing departments, everyone's got to be part of the process. Mm-hmm. And so that's true, whether it's essentially, it's almost like, where's the funding coming in? Funding coming from government? Cool. Funding coming from nonprofit? In any case, we got to work with everyone if we mm-hmm. want to build things that are really going to work, that are really going to be sustainable. And in some cases, like we're doing work right now through a nonprofit where the long-term sustainability model is we want government to take it on. So we need to make sure that what we're doing is going to serve their end. So they're a stakeholder now, because the nonprofit wants to make sure that they're not going to always have to go raise funding for it. Yeah. So they're having us pull in government stakeholders to interview them to make sure that this is meeting their needs, so that the product, which serves advocates, is also going to serve government, so that it has a built-in financial sustainability model. So yeah, all the work feels very
interconnected, I would say.
Interconnected. Yeah, for a while, Exegy was talking about like we were working on like our civic side and our health side, and like government and civic community organizations and health was like health equity and healthcare. And then like we just realized it was all like the same work, right? Like we were working in the Department of Public Health. What was that? You know? And then all of it was we just realized all our work, you know, is best served by us bringing everyone together.
Okay. Now, with that in mind, bringing everyone together, as a small business, what have you learned about bringing government agencies to the table and including them in this process that kind of associates with the procurement aspect of it?
You want to talk about procurement? How much time we have left? because like you said earlier, that's like a whole a whole other conversation. I mean, my stupid joke that I say all the time, and so hopefully no one who's talked to me before is listening to this, but is it like, you know, I've been spending the last 5 years earning my master's in procurement, right? Yeah. By accident, I've had to learn this wonky topic, which is like, you know, you asked me to define open source, so I'll just take a second to define procurement. Procurement is how government buys things, right? And for good reason, there are a lot of rules around procurement, right? In my mind, the main reason is that if there weren't rules, then Donald Trump Jr. would have every contract. And that would suck. I mean, depending on where you fall, I guess, but I think that would suck.
I want some contracts myself.
You want some?
I want some contracts myself.
Not all for him. So those rules are put in place for good reason, right? Like, you know, we want to make things fair. But as we said earlier, like, the layers upon layers upon layers upon layers of rules means that you have to spend 5 years getting your master's in procurement in order to be able to work with government, which is a tremendous barrier to entry, which means that most small businesses give up.
That's true.
They give up the first time they try, because it is literally, I mean, it is so much paperwork and reading through like legalese and having to interpret it, and then often ended up finding yourself getting disqualified after putting in dozens or hundreds of hours into responding to an RFP because you didn't understand some stupid rule that like they wrote, or you thought it wasn't important because it seemed ridiculous. But like, you know, what you learn, like all those things that seem ridiculous are actually, you actually have to pay attention to each one of those rules, you know? And like, man, like before the pandemic, this has at least gotten a little better, but before the pandemic, I mean, a lot of governments made you like respond to RFPs with printed triplicate, you know? Like we had one thing, we responded to the state of California. I had to drive up to Sacramento after spending like all night at Kinko's, you know, like stapling and hole punching and like, you know, a lot of organizations who do a lot of government work, the big organizations do a lot of work, they have a whole team for just that. Like they call it a capture team, I think. And like, it's, should that exist? Like, should like part of the economy be dedicated to like that, to like, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. And then it creates this barrier to entry where like, companies that win procurements are the ones that are good at doing procurement. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you're good at doing whatever it is that they're trying to procure. It just matters if you're good at procurement. And that seems like a pretty poor incentive if we're interested in an efficient use of taxpayer dollars. So, you know, procurement should be drowned in a bathtub. Not that they're all good people, but like procurement, it just needs to be wildly reformed. And every, like, you know, everyone who goes into government, they think their first like month, they're like, I'm going to change everything. And then they like try and do something and they're like, what's this procurement thing? And they're like, ah, this is crazy. How does this exist? I'm going to fix it. And then they like try and fix it. And then they, boom, they run up against a wall and they're like, oh, and then that's part of like the soul crushing experience, I think. And then, you know, you're officially a bureaucrat at that point. So there are some things, like I said, we've learned some things and gotten better a bit. One of our colleagues and friends is an organization called Co-Procure.
Yeah.
Have you talked to them on this podcast?
I haven't had her on yet, but she's going to be on.
Mario. Yeah, you got to have Mario on. Mario. She knows everything about this thing called piggybacking or cooperative purchasing, which is this idea that, okay, the rules are there for a good reason. We want things to be done fairly. But if one government did that, they had a fair process, went through all those hoops, everyone went through all those hoops, then like, can another government just like buy that same thing on that same contract? Because that was done fairly. Can they piggyback on a already competitively bid process? Or cooperative purchasing, which is like, can a bunch of governments decide to like do it all at once together so that like not every 58 counties in California, do all of them need to like write a procurement for hammers, you know, or can like they all just like do one hammer procurement, you know? And so like, that's cool. We're trying to do more of that. We're building in this piggybacking language into our contracts with government. And we're going to other governments and we're being like, hey, if you're interested in working with us, this is an easy way to do it. Other governments have already vetted that we are cool, that we are fair, that our prices are fair. So like you could just use their contract and we're not getting a ton of traction with it, but it's getting more and more. Like, I think I just really want Mariel to like, here to like get everyone to drink that Kool-Aid, because it's going to make government better. It's going to make my life easier, but it's also going to make government better. So that's one thing. Another thing is, you know, like I said, these RFPs get written over the course of a year and the government hates them. So they're like, we don't have to do it again. So they pack everything in. It becomes a 200-page list of assumptions. Don't do that, right? Do not do that. Build in a phased approach where the first phase is, let's figure out what we're going to do after that, right? Like we call, you know, in the private sector, we call it discovery, right? So build in discovery and a big phase, like that it's the most important thing you're going to do. Yeah. So like build it in, pay for it, budget for it, and build your procurement so that like you don't have to then stop after discovery and then go do another procurement, you know, like build it in so you can just go straight from phase one where you figure out what you're going to do into phase two. And there's lots of examples of procurements like that, that you can build on. Like you don't have to just start from scratch. Like, you know, at the federal level, organizations like 18F and USDS have been really like leading the way in terms of helping to design procurements that and provide guidance to procurement professionals about how to set procurements up in this way. And there's a lot of examples at the state and local level as well that either build on what 18F and USDS has done or have built on what the state of California or other organizations have done. Build in an iterative research discovery led process. Or, you know, you're going to end up, like I said, 5 years in, launching something that nobody asked
about. Nobody cares about. Okay, so my final question. Well, this is like a closeout, but what is in the future for Exegy? Like, what is next? And governmental work. So what is next?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, we're just about to take on a really exciting new project. It's a second big open source project to serve state and local government, just like our FUZZ product. It's a little more, I think, broadly focused on social services. Okay. Can't say a lot more about it yet because it's like, it's not like, I hate like stealth mode, but it's we're working with our funder. And so as soon as we've gotten that finalized, we'll be big announcement, super exciting. We'll share it with you, I promise. Okay. So really excited about that work because, well, one, because it's exactly the kind of work we love to do, right? It's taking design and technology and making governments better at delivering social services. Heck yeah, that's what we want to do.
Of course.
Two, I'm really excited about it because we've learned so much over the last 6-7 years doing the work with Bloom Housing, learning how to take an open source product and build it in a way such that it's usable by a city or a state or a county or, you know, and then how to go to other governments and be like, hey, you can use this, and how to build a business model around that. And so we learned so much about that. And now to be able to take all the lessons that we've learned from that experience on Bloom and apply it to another project and product, I'm super excited about. And my hope is that this is the beginning of us being able to do that with many different, become the stewards of many different open source products that serve government. So if anyone out there has an open source product that serves government, you need a steward for, hey, Exegy's over here.
Definitely. No, we have a product. It's currently not open source, but it would be something to definitely have a conversation with Exegy about.
I'd love to learn more.
Yeah.
Always happy to meet people and learn about what they're doing. Cause you know, that's like, I mean, it's inside, but like, that's all I really like doing is just hearing what people are up to. But, then also like talking about what I'm up to, obviously, but, but because also like, that's just, you know, that's how you meet great folks who are doing work that they give a crap about and that's going to make the world better. And so like, yeah, that's what Exegy is trying to continue to do, is just find ways for us to grow space on our team for more folks to come to be able to do that selfish thing I talked about, which is to have work that they care about, to be able to use their skills to make the world better. And so if Exegy grows, we have more seats at the table for more people to come and do that. And if Exegy grows, then we are impacting the world more positively and making social services better, making governments better, making NGOs better. And, you know, I think my belief has always been that technology can be a profound force for good.
Of course.
We have certainly seen a lot of examples to the contrary over the past few years, but I still believe that there is a lot of room for technologists, designers, folks who are sort of like infrastructuralists, those of us who are digital, to help organizations to get better to deliver critical services more efficiently and effectively.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you were just saying, if anyone had a project or an open source solution that needed a steward, how can someone find out more information about Exegy and how can they do business with you guys?
Oh, thanks for asking. You know, Exegy is really hard to spell. It's EXYGY.com. I'm sure it's like down in the show notes if we're on YouTube.
Yeah, it's going to be in the description box, all of the links and everything.
And so you just find us on the website. Hello at Exegy.com goes to me and Ivy, and who's on our team and amazing, and you would love to talk to. How else? Yeah, we just have a contact form. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm just always open to connecting with folks, because like I said, that's all I like to do. So
Zach, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for coming, sharing this information. And if there's ever anything that, you know, is coming up or you want us to share, let us know, because I feel like this work is community focused, and that's exactly the point of this podcast. Our community is comprised of small business owners who are really micro businesses and woman-owned, minority-owned, and veteran-owned businesses as well. So if you ever have anything you want us to put out to the small business community, let us know. And thank you so much. I appreciate it.
This was fun. Thanks for having me, Shakira.
Thank you. So you have a good one, Zach. And bye. Everyone, do not forget to like, comment, subscribe, and reach out to Exegy. Even if you just go check out the website to see some of the projects they're working on, you could definitely be an advocate for bringing these type of projects into your local area. Like, they're in California and working throughout the state. They're in Detroit now, but I'm in Florida and I can see this as being an opportunity to work here. So don't forget, go take a look at that and then reach back out and see how you can provide these in your area. Until next time, I will see you all on another episode of the Government Coins Podcast. That is it. Peace.